Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're going to explore a very interesting world in the course of this hour. Our print partner here in the Mark Steiner Show is Urbanite Magazine, and we produce every month Urbanite radio stories out of their issues. And today we're devoting a full hour to one of the articles that appeared in this month's issue, Unwrap the Hidden City is this issue. And it was a story written by Martha Thomas, who's one of our guests and joins us in the studio, called The Departed. And the subtitle here that was by the picture is Darlene Bass doesn't know who killed her son or why. All she knows is that he needed a proper burial. And that's just the beginning of the story. This is not a story just about inner cities and young people dying, though that's a piece of the story. It's not just a story about the cost of funerals. That's just a piece of the story. But it's the story of burial and ritual and what that means in the African-American world. It's a story of how that's divided sometimes by class and region. It's a story about how people who have run funeral homes in the African-American world for the last 150 years have been the pillar of the African-American middle class. Preachers, teachers, some doctors and lawyers, but funeral directors were there. And for generations, the same families have run these funeral homes and passed from father to son and daughter and managing these homes. And the split sometimes that happens in the between black and poor middle class worlds over what's proper behavior at a funeral? What does emotion mean? How is it let go and let out? So we're going to talk about that and a lot more. So as I said, Martha Thomas is with us, who's a contributing writer to the Urbanite magazine, who wrote the story, The Departed. It appears in this May issue. Joseph Brown Jr. is with us. He's the president and mortician, chief owner and operator of the Joseph Brown Jr. Funeral Home. Annette March Greer is with us, vice president for marketing at March Funeral Homes and a bereavement counselor at Roberta's House, a family bereavement and law center. Worked in the Justice Department under President Clinton, and I didn't mention that, but Roberta's House and approaching bereavement for young people is a piece of what we're going to talk about in families this hour with Annette March Greer. And on the phone is Dr. Ronald Barrett, who went to Morgan State University, went on to get his PhD, and is now professor of psychology at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles, who's working on a book about African-American mourning rituals and is one of the leading experts, if not the leading expert in this country, on this issue. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ronald, you can hear us well, Ronald?
Yes.
Good. Welcome. Good to have you with us. I've been enjoying reading about you on the web and pieces I've been finding about that your thoughts. So I'm looking forward to you being a part of this conversation as well.
Thank you.
So it is interesting. I mean, this is a world, I think. Oh, by the way, the phones are open, 410-319-8888. Here, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Now, I'm curious. Let's start with Martha Thomas, and she's a writer. Wrote the article, brought this all to our attention in this issue of The Urbanite. And what drove you to this story?
Well, I was very curious about the differences in rituals and funerals in all cultures, not just black and white cultures. And so I just started looking into it. I think one of the things that was very telling is when I was in the process of doing this story, I was at the Y, and a woman at the locker next to mine said, "Oh, I've got such a busy week. I got 3 funerals." And I thought, man, I've been to 3 funerals in my life. You know, I feel like there's this cultural divide. And so that was really part of it.
And the story focused, at least the part of the story focused on Delvon Rashad Butts, who was laid to rest last October and who was 15 years old when he was shot and killed. Nobody knows to this day whether or not he was the intended victim of the shooting, but he died in the hospital after being shot. Another young man was shot as well. So, but there is a difference here. I think it's interesting. I mean, when you look at it historically, we'll start with Ronald Barrett. And when you look at it historically, the question of bereavement, of loss, has had a very different, a profoundly different kind of role in the black world from before slavery through emancipation and into this modern world. Is that fair to say, Ronald Barrett?
I think it's correct and a fair statement. And it's also a statement of profound irony, because when I first became involved in the research in death and dying, or thanatology as it's called, one of the things that struck me as a strange irony was that there was very little written about African Americans. And it's not like we didn't have much experience with death and dying.
Right.
Just the contrary. We've had more than our share. But there was such an absence in the research literature about the way that we approach death and dying. And that's what motivated me and has kept me passionate about, you know, the work in this field in terms of trying to contribute something about our very important sacred and honored tradition. So, I think probably, Mark, to go back to your original question, I think if you look at loss in a very general way, and if you look at death and dying, African Americans, arguably, I would certainly make the point, have had more than their share. They're probably disproportionately impacted by losses of a variety of sorts, and I probably could cite statistics that would show that we live less longer, we die earlier, we die a more painful death, and in many cases, we do suffer from bereavement overload in terms of the multiplicity of losses that most other people don't have to struggle with. So it does provide a different kind of picture about the black experience for us compared to other folks.
I do want to parse that out, everything you just said, because I think that's really important to get to. But I'm going to turn to our other two guests in the room here, Annette March Greer and Joseph Brown, and also appreciate you both coming into the studio and being part of this article as well and being part of our Urbanite podcast. Both of you come from families that have been in this business for a long time.
Very long time.
I take a little historical perspective from the two of you just for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And talk about what it means for the two of you to be in families, to come from families that have been in this business for generations and generations, and why you think that the funeral business has became such a pillar in the post-emancipation world as kind of a pillar of the middle class in the black world.
I'd like to address that question. I grew up in a funeral parlor, living above the funeral parlor. Mm-hmm. And the funeral home downstairs was very much a community center. Every Sunday, especially, after church, families, the church ladies, would come to the funeral parlor to see who was there, whether they knew who was in there or not. Mm-hmm. Most oftentimes, they did know who was there. And the community funeral home, the local funeral home, funeral director, I think represented that support that didn't exist or wasn't available to African Americans in the community. My mom was the counselor, the social worker, the therapist. The community pooled there together to gain support for each other in trying times, in difficult times, when death occurred within the community and within families. So that's why I think that the funeral home or the funeral director has been such a viable individual or stakeholder in the community, in the African-American community, because that was the emotional support place.
Mm-hmm. Justin Brown?
Yes, yes. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, first of all, I'm Joseph H. Brown III, and the reason why I say that, my father was a junior, I'm a fourth-generation mortician. My family, it's my sister and I now, Charlene D. Brown Baldwin. We own the oldest operating black funeral home in Baltimore. I'm a mortician. I'm an embalmer. That's what I do. That's what I specialize in. I see the need for the grief counseling and what have you that my colleague brings to the table, especially in these times when we are experiencing such a prevalence of death, and we haven't really seen it yet. This is what I call, Martha and I talk about it, this is what I call the quiet before the storm, because, you know, the largest segment of the American population, the baby boomer, is nearing 70 years of age.
We're not there yet.
No, we're not there yet.
Yeah, we need all the time we can get.
Thank you, Ronald. Thank you. No, don't put us there yet, man. We'll visit you later.
Okay, all right. Hang in there. But biblically speaking, 70. We're talking the largest segment of the American population. So I think this is really the quiet before the storm that, you know, Martha was talking about, the three funerals in a week. I think that will probably be the norm, if not even more so. But why, the question is why have funeral homes become pillars of society, of the communities? Well, our funeral home started in South Baltimore, in the shadows of Camden Yards, in a community called Otterbein, in a row house. And my great-grandfather was a cabinet maker, and he also had horses and buggies. So he had the necessary ingredients, as Martha would say. He had the necessary ingredients to become the undertaker. That was a word we know about.
That was the word.
He became the undertaker, okay? And his home became the funeral home. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we became so entrenched in the community, because it was on a personal level. You knew the undertaker. You knew where he lived. And back in those days, people would come, and my father tells stories of people coming at 2 o'clock in the morning when the bar is closed and knocking on the door to see Mr. Jones. Okay. We still do have extended viewing times.
But not at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Not at 2 o'clock in the morning. But we do have day long viewings versus, like, mm-hmm. say the white community, which does 2 to 4, 6 to 8. We do all day long.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Same in March.
Same. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you, go ahead, Ronald, come back in. Go ahead.
Just add something.
Please do.
I have a colleague here who got a grant from the Lilly Foundation, and he's doing a project where he's looking at the movers and shakers that basically were the founders of early Los Angeles. And his preliminary research has shown that many of the early founding fathers of L.A., and it's probably true across the country, Baltimore, New York, Atlanta, Chicago, they were primarily morticians. They were your lawyers and doctors. And these were people who had the ability to speak out and be on the cutting edge, on the front line, because they were not as susceptible to the constraints and the manipulation of the power structure. These were entrepreneurial families, mm-hmm. people who basically were a little bit immune from, you know, the kinds of things that other folk were constrained around, because they were pretty much independent. They were more independently oriented. So I think across the country, you have black leaders who were the movers and shakers, who basically were dependent upon the black community as their constituency, and they were also able to speak for that community in terms of giving voice to needs and things that other folk didn't have a voice or an opportunity or a platform to speak around. So I think across our experience, we find that we've depended upon church leaders and our professionals, and I think funeral directors were very, 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 very intricately involved in terms of providing that kind of leadership, because they, again, they were a little bit less susceptible to the manipulation that others were susceptible to.
That's really interesting. I want to come back to explore that in some greater depth. I think that it's because it is a very profoundly different experience between the white world and most other worlds in America and the black world and funeral homes and the role they play because of the oppression and separation, because of slavery and then segregation and all the rest, and the role that played and the minimal opportunities that existed for people in the black world for so long, that this became such a powerful institution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems a phenomenon most people, I mean, outside the community itself, don't really have a grasp of. Were you going to say something, Martha?
Well, to sort of complete the answer to your question about why I chose to do this story, it's also a very personal story. And I think that one of the things that happened here is that the family was really struggling to figure out how to bury this boy. And whether or not, you know, he was, I mean, I think that their memory of him was that he was a good boy, laughed, you know, filled with joy, played with his nephews, and they were just devastated by his loss. And, you know, Annette is talking about the funeral home as like a center of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, and no offense, Joe, to your business, that they really, they were kind of like left out in the cold. You know, part of the story, part of the narrative of the story is following them in their quest to come up with the money to pay for this funeral. So in a sense, you know, it's sort of lost its bearing in a way.
Well, no, I was going to take it somewhere else from there, but since you raised that, let's talk about that for a minute. No, that's fine. Take us anywhere you want. I'll always come back to where I was. No, this is fine. That's what we did. It's like a conversation on my kitchen table. You just have a microphone in front of your face. That's all this is. But we're talking about the world of burial, the ritual burial, funerals in the black world. There was an article called The Departed, written by Martha Thomas in this month's Urbanite. This is one of our Urbanite radio hours. You just heard Martha Thomas's voice. Joseph Brown, who's owner-operator of the Joseph Brown Jr. Funeral Home, is with us, along with Annette March Greer, who's vice president for marketing at the March Funeral Homes, and a bereavement counselor at Roberta's House. And she worked in the Justice Department under President Clinton. Dr. Ronald Barrett is with us, professor of psychology at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles, who's writing a book about African-American mourning rituals and probably the nation's leading expert in this world. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Come right to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Nick, you've been holding on a while. We're going to come to your call because you have an important question to ask. I'm going to raise this issue here because it kind of maybe fits into your call. And the question becomes, I mean, funeral homes, I don't care what culture they were at this point with this question. Back in the early 1900s, late 1800s, were places that served communities, and the issue of money and monies were very different in 1900 and 1920 and 1880 than they are in 2009. And now you have 40% or more of the African-American world mired in urban poverty, some of the worst poverty this country has ever known. And people cannot afford funerals often, and we, in this article, The Departed, the only reason this family came up with the $5,000 that they needed to help pay for the funeral is because their son was shot and they got the money from the state, because the state has a certain amount of money, funds to pay out people around $5,000 a piece to pay for funerals.
And they've run out.
And they've run out. And they have, and they have run out.
And they have run out.
So what happens? What happens? And then I'm going to ask you too personally what happens here, mm-hmm. with your work. But talk about Ronald Barrett in a larger national sense, what that means.
Well, you know, you say $5,000. If you were to talk about the white experience, you would consider that a very, very inexpensive funeral.
Oh, no. What I'm asking though is and let me go to Ronald Barrett, then come right back to Joseph and Annette. But is the question is, how does that affect? It is low, but if you make barely $10,000 a year, or you're living on subsistence, low wage jobs, what does it mean culturally and nationally, Ronald Barrett?
Well, I think according to the figures are constantly changing, but the last estimate that I heard in FDA was estimating that the average funeral was somewhere around $7,500, give or take. Okay. So I think Joseph's point is well taken. I think $5,000 is fairly cheap.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a very inexpensive, low-cost service. And what that does what that does present is a conundrum. It's a difficulty for families, as Martha pointed out, to come up with an awful lot of money in a short amount of time. And it is a Herculean effort. So unless there are subsidies, unless you have programs to provide assistance for victims of violent crimes, and many municipalities do that, then you're talking about families having to struggle to pull a service together. And also, in terms of the Black tradition, there's a lot of pressure on families to do it and do it well.
Right.
Because there's a lot of cultural expectations that, you know, we tend to put on the dog and pony show.
Dr. Barrett, one thing, Annette will tell you that mostly our business is not a cash business. It's based on insurances, and a lot of times, especially in the younger casualties, you'll find out that grandma has the policy. Mm-hmm. Grandma has the policy that pays for the funeral. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, I know you've seen this, and that grandma took out a policy when the child was born, and that usually takes care of the majority of the funeral expenses. So we definitely don't have a cash business, and when we do cash business, it's more so the exception than the rule. Wouldn't you agree with that, Annette?
I do. And
go ahead, Annette. Then we'll come up with Annette.
Oftentimes, there is no insurance policy, and so the hat is passed around throughout the family, throughout the churches, in the community.
That's an important point.
Because, you know, these families are living day to day, and it hasn't changed very much. In fact, that's how my father established his business, by serving those who could not afford to go to the other funeral homes that refused to serve them because they did not have insurance. That's how March Funeral Homes was established.
Is your father or grandfather?
Both of my parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were there to serve some of those families, charging next to nothing, because it was taking place in our home that the funeral service was conducted. So he had the leverage to be able to help those families who were in social services and still wanted a decent, dignified service for their family, you know, their family mm-hmm. member. So things haven't changed very much at all. And now, you know, we're talking about a recession. Social services now has run out of the $600 that they used to supply towards a funeral bill. I mean, $600 towards a funeral bill. I think Maryland's probably one of the lowest states.
$650, and there's a cap on the amount that can be spent on a social service funeral to just increase from $1,500 to $2,500.
Martha, you were going to say something?
Well, I was just going to jump in here because this brings to mind something that Dr. Barrett told me in the interview, in the story. You know, if a family, a grandma, buys an insurance policy for a child when it's born, there are some communities where the grandparent opens a college fund mm-hmm. for a child mm-hmm. when the child is born. And it reminds me, Dr. Barrett, of what you said about, you know, youths planning their own funerals and thinking more about that as their future, as thinking about, you know, going to the prom or graduating from high school or going to college. And I, you know, Joe's mention of grandma having an insurance policy for a child is, it breaks my heart.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I would certainly want to speak to right away, and that is, I've been studying, you know, Black funerals for quite a while, and one of the things that I'm really uncomfortable with is the tremendous pressure that a lot of families feel to live up to expectations, to put on an elaborate dog and pony show, sometimes at the expense of other survival, you know, priorities. So how do we begin to have a more reasonable, if you, for lack of a better word, approach to, you know, funeral rites or last rituals where we don't put everything necessarily into the ground or into the funeral, but that there is money put aside maybe to help with the quality of life of those who are going to be left behind, so that you can begin to think about, as Martha's talking about, essential things like, you know, insurance, about health care costs, about graduation, about estate planning. How do we do that as a community in such a way that we have a better balance? Because, you know, Joseph was talking about, you know, the proverbial dilemma for baby boomers, but before we get to that, we got an economy that is literally breaking the backs of people, and I think we're going to see, way before what Joseph predicts, we're going to see a lot of bizarre, aberrant things where violent crime is expected to increase, and we're going to see probably a lot of suffering of people who are marginalized and who are perhaps not in the best of circumstances financially, trying to be able to get through this tough economic period that we're in. So I've been very concerned about crime statistics going up in response to the recession.
Well, you and know, Dr. Barrett, the funeral ritual in the African American community was it has its history, and its history was really established during slavery, when the best thing that could happen was to go to a better place, where the best thing that could happen was to have the day to celebrate the fact that a loved one has gone on.
We have to take a short break. That's a really important point to kind of explore, and I do want to explore it when we come back, burial traditions and how they and why they are with you. And I think you're touching the root of it, Joseph Brown. We're back with Annette March Greer, Martha Thomas with the article in the Urbanite, that part of our Urbanite radio series. Dr. Ronald Barrett joins us by phone. We come back, we are going to go right to the phones here. Nikki in Baltimore, you've been holding on for a while. We're going to go to you, and it looks like a relative of Annette's is on the line, too. We'll go to him as well. 410-319-8888 is the number here. I want to let you all know about a great event coming up that I hope you'll be part of. On Wednesday, May 27th, please join me at 6 p.m. for a live broadcast of The Mark Steiner Show at the Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University. I'll be interviewing Bob Luke, author of the new book, The Baltimore Elite Giants. Joining us on stage will be Bert Simmons, who was a pitcher on that team. We talk about the Negro Baseball Leagues. This live broadcast will be followed by a book signing and a reception. You can go to steinershow.org or call 410-516-4162 for more information. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And welcome to another one of our Urbanite radio broadcasts, where we every month take articles out of the Urbanite magazine and turn them into radio conversations or small documentaries for you to enjoy, listen to, and participate in. We are joined at this hour by Martha Thomas, who wrote the article, The Departed, about the funeral world and the world of burial in the African-American community. We are joined by Joseph Brown, Jr., who is owner and operator of the Joseph Brown, Jr. Funeral Home, who is
third.
I'm the third.
Yeah.
I keep saying Jr., you're third.
I'm third. Excuse
me.
My father.
Joseph, and it says right here on your card, Joseph Brown, third. And not to be mistaken for his father. And Annette March Greer is with us, Vice President for Marketing at March Funeral Homes and a bereavement counselor at Roberta's House, which we have to get to talk about a bit. Dr. Ronald Barrett, Professor of Psychology at Loyola Marymount in L.A., is working on a book on African-American mourning rituals. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And I know Annette wants to say something about what Ronald said, but I did promise to get this caller here, and then we'll come right back to that thought. 410-319-8888. Nikki in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, and I'm glad that I held for a long time because you all raised some issues that I wanted to comment on, so I'll make this very brief. But I wanted to touch upon the mainstay of the mortician as the one of the central figures in the black middle class. I come from a family of morticians who started in Houston. We're one of the oldest black families in Houston that still run, and that's Wiley Funeral Home. And the founders of the original Wiley, they moved out to Los Angeles, where they then continued that tradition. And drawing on, you know, the other kind of black entrepreneurs in terms of being morticians and doctors and lawyers, I want to add to that beauticians, because it was my great-grandmother and her sisters who started a funeral home and a beauty shop, and they were right next to each other in the sisters who were the beauticians would do the hair of the dead and help with the body preparations. I just wanted to touch upon that, and, you know, I just think it's so incredible that you all are talking about this because it is very personal to me. But my original question, my son is in the car now, so I can't talk as candidly as I would like to, but my mother recently passed, and it was very sudden. And I'm obviously still dealing with it, but we are approaching a sick relative, and my son is 10. And so I ironically just called his guidance counselor at school yesterday to seek out resources in terms of the process. It's very different, and it's much easier when something is sudden versus watching sickness. Mm-hmm. And so that's my question, really, in terms of what I'm seeking. But I am looking for resources for an African-American child in dealing with sickness, death, and dying, and all of those things. And also, you know, in dealing with the residual effects of the sudden loss of my mother and then even an uncle before that.
I'm sorry for all your loss.
You all also for this conversation. This is awesome. Thanks.
Nikki,
and
thank you.
Hang up now.
All right, then. Thank you so much. I'm sorry for your loss. So much has happened to you.
Yes.
But I think that's a good question for Annette March Greer, actually.
Yes. First, I want to applaud you for even having the desire to want to find resources and support for your son. And I invite you to call Roberta's House, and we can provide some information and support programs that are upcoming in the near future for your son. But the most one piece of advice that I would give you right now is to please keep him inclusive in everything that happens in that family process, and simply answer whatever questions that he has as simply as you possibly can and truthfully, without any, I guess, false, you know, stories to sort of elude that you might feel that might make him safe. Be very frank and say, I don't know, or I don't quite understand when things like this happen either, but it's important that we're together as a family during this time. And I think that's the greatest gift that you can give him, and to be as honest and genuine with him as possible.
And we can give information about Roberta's House will be on our website, steinershow.org. We'll make sure that gets up there so people can go up there and try to give us more information by the end of the hour. Our next caller is Eric March, who's on the road.
Hey, Eric.
Eric, you're on the air.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome.
Hey. Hi, Joe. Hi, Annette.
Hello.
The only reason I called in is because this conversation was dealing a lot with the historical perspective, and I've written articles on the history of African-American funeral customs. And I think one thing that needs to be understood in terms of understanding why the funeral ritual is so important in the black community is that at one time in this country, it was illegal to have a funeral for a black person. At a time when black people were considered livestock and not given any human dignity, they were not allowed to commemorate the life of a fellow person. And also, there were laws against assembly so that people couldn't even gather when someone died for fear of insurrection. So, you know, there was a time when black people couldn't even have a funeral. I've come across passages where it was children who were used to dig graves in a non-crop producing piece of land
mm-hmm.
when a slave died. And so things didn't really change until the Nat Turner event, when it was clear that some pacification was needed to calm the black slave population. And so they started to relax some of those laws and prohibitions, and people were allowed to remember their fellow human being in a ritual. And so that in itself, I think, gave great importance to the funeral ritual within the black community. And it's been carried on ever since.
Eric Marsh, I'm glad you raised those issues and brought them up, because I'd like to talk a bit more about that and then come back to a question I think Annette had before we went to break, which is the funeral tradition that is in the African-American world. You alluded to it a little bit. Joseph Brown alluded. You talked about it earlier in the show when you talked about going to a better place, and that, you know, that was to get out of the pains of this earth and into a better place.
It's a celebratory event.
A celebratory, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that people's emotions mm-hmm. were allowed to burst mm-hmm. open, mm-hmm. whether mm-hmm. it was through, as in New Orleans, through music, dance, and celebration.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Or whether it's just letting the almost visceral emotions explode mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in pain and grief and not be ashamed of it.
Mm-hmm. So it was not just for the dead. It was for the living,
absolutely.
You see? And the reason why, you know, and that this grief counseling is, you know, there's a movement to get away from the funeral. When you get away from see, we didn't invent the funeral. The funeral has been around for a long time. It serves a purpose. When my grandfather died, I was in the Navy. I was off the coast of Maui. I came back to Baltimore, and I grieved. But you know what? After the funeral, it was a long funeral, I was better. I didn't have to get a prescription. I didn't have to go lay on a psychiatrist's couch. I had catharsis. I felt better within myself. Now, you take away the funeral and you trivialize the funeral and the passage from life until death, you'll have a lot more people at Roberta's place because need help.
Now, Ronald Barrett, bring you back into this conversation, and Annette March-Creer and Martha Thomas as well. I mean, to take this further, I have a friend of mine who just passed in January. He had brain cancer. He was just a year younger than me, and he died very quickly. And I was with him a lot before he died. I went out to the West Coast where he lived and stayed with him a lot before he died, as his best friends did. And one of the things he said to us, he went down to Mississippi to live for 3 years. And he was in Mississippi. He was from New York. And he went to Mississippi to live. He always hated funerals and never wanted to go to funerals and didn't want to get anywhere near them. But an old farmer down the road from the farm he took over from his family farm, when he thought he could be a farmer, the founder, he wasn't going to be a farmer. But at any rate, he went out to visit this man, and he was very close to him, and he died. And he said, "I'm never going to a funeral. I'm not going to a funeral." And then his family said, "You got to come. You have to come." So he went to this man's funeral. He said, and he told me, he said, "Mark, I never experienced anything like that. All of a sudden, there were bottles of whiskey everywhere, and people were talking, and they were dancing, and they were laughing, and they were crying, and it was a celebration of this man's life, and people were embracing each other in this community." And he said, "And when I go, man, I want you to do this for me," you know, and so it was like, and that was very much speaking to coming out of the black world, a culture about what it means, what you do. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the Irish in some ways, what you do mm-hmm. when you pass. And, mm-hmm. And Ronald Barrett, why don't you kick off that part of our discussion, then we'll go around the room.
Well, let me just say that very quickly. I think that funerals are very important. I think that mourning is a very important activity. I think that we need to encourage people to attend to themselves and to attend to the necessary task of mourning losses. And people may stylize that very differently. And again, everybody doesn't have to have a very elaborate funeral, and there are very different approaches that people can take. But we do want to encourage people to do whatever is right and comfortable for them in order to get emotional closure. We do think that that's very important. So with all that, you know, said and done, I think that we want to encourage people. And a lot of people will say, you know, my dad was the same way. My father did not attend his mother's funeral, his father's funeral, nor his sister's funeral. And it was because I think he couldn't handle it. But it was, you know, and we used to always tease him and ask him, well, what happens if one of your kids die? And he said, well, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. Mm. Fortunately, he never had that, you know, that dilemma, but he just would never go to a funeral. So there are people who, for any number of reasons, find funerals, you know, difficult to talk about or to approach. But it is a very important thing that communities and, you know, people need to continue. My concern is that a lot of the generation of kids that are coming along, they're losing a lot of the understanding about the importance of rituals or how one should dress, how one should conduct oneself at a funeral, you know. And there is some concern about us losing our cultural tradition because a lot of it hasn't been well documented or passed on. But I do think the process of funeralization is very important psychologically for people's emotional health. Is that what you were...
No, that's fine. This is a great way to start this off. And Annette, Joseph, you want to jump in on this? Or Martha, too, but I'll just go around the room here.
Yeah.
Joseph?
Absolutely. And what you're seeing... is that the times they are changing and things are being done differently today than they that they were yesterday. But when you see the turnout in the young people's funerals, you know how important that that this is. The fact that people come, you know, sometimes people only come together for weddings and funerals. You know,
too often.
Yeah. Right. So. So what you're seeing, I mean, with the clothing and the activities, and we know, Annette and I know, funerals can be very, very emotive, and they can be wild, and they can go right on. This is in the black community now, and the white community is very polite. There's not even that much, to me, my personal observation, there's not even that much attention to the body. But in the black community, it's totally opposite.
Mm-hmm.
We in the casket,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay, so that is the baggy clothes and those are just signs of the time. But the grief is still real.
Oh, absolutely.
The loss is still real, and we're learning how to deal with it in the black community on another level, because there are some people who are starting to marginalize the importance of what we do. And when we start to marginalize the importance of death care, we're going to have to start treating people mentally and psychologically, and we should be treating people mentally and psychologically anyway.
Absolutely.
And that's something that has not existed in the black community until recently. And people like, you know, Annette and her family, you know, are bringing that to the forefront.
I think that we have, as a society, come to a point that we need to start dealing with death and loss issues in our communities, in our culture, as a society of people, more. We've denied it for as long as we possibly can, I believe, and not talking about it, in not embracing the emotions, by not addressing the process that we need and looking at grief as a healing process. And it's interesting now that mourning 50 years ago, mm-hmm. were signs of maybe wearing black, having a drape over the door or a wreath on the door, yeah, or a badge around the arm. And if you ask a young person today, they don't know anything about those symbols and signs.
The screen printed t-shirts.
And you ask them, well, what are the signs of mourning today that you see?
Right.
And you'll hear that long list. The tattoos on the body of all the, or on their bodies, the living bodies.
The name of the person
tattooed. Of all the names.
Rest in place.
The rip, the t-shirts, the caps, the bandanas, the symbols of the traditions of what they create, even at the funeral
teddy bears
ceremonies.
In place, the RIPs spray painted on walls.
Yes, yes. And even now the elementary children are carrying obituaries in their school binders.
Right.
And yet nobody is recognizing these signs or symbols and
as
acknowledging
legitimate, legitimate.
As legitimate ways of grieving. You know, now, we're all saying you're crazy.
And I'm so glad that Martha had the chance to come into the funeral home, to come into the community, to see and experience exactly what Annette is talking about.
And I think it goes a lot deeper than just these mourning signs with our young people, especially right now, because I think that we need to start making the connections with the lack of supportive systems in place with the death and the loss that our children are witnessing and experiencing day to day. There's a lot of anger with our young people.
A lot.
A lot of
and
anger.
Pain.
Because they are not. I'm sorry.
On that note, let me jump right in and not be
sure. Go ahead.
Modest in terms of encouraging people to please check out Roberta's House, check out the work that Annette is pioneering. I think she is doing some very important work nationally. She's trying to, I think, establish a model that could certainly be applicable nationwide. And it is of extreme importance that we as a community begin to deal seriously with the importance of grieving. And I say that because Joseph was saying we will have problems. We have problems. It is my contention that a lot of the violence that we see is unresolved grief.
Yes.
Where people who are agitated, they're upset, and they are retaliatory, and it is a snowball effect where one kid gets killed, his homies get all antsed up and gassed up, and they go out and retaliate, and you have a snowball effect that is fueling the violence that is so much a problem in our community. I think a lot of the violence that we see today is unresolved grief. And going back to the caller who called in, the only thing that I would say to her in terms of revisiting that, in terms of saying this, please also, the community needs to know that not all counselors are skilled with grief and loss.
That is so true.
So even the most well-trained psychiatrists and psychologists will not necessarily have that expertise. It is shocking and appalling that most psychologists, I finished graduate training without any courses on death and dying. It's almost as if I was given a piece of paper and say, you go out work with people, but you don't need to know nothing about death and dying because that's not a part of, you know, human experience. That was almost what they were telling me. But I've come to learn that death and dying is so much a part of our experience that we have to deal with it as a community, and professionally, we also have to recognize different levels of competence. And to say nothing about the fact that we also want to make sure that when you take your sons and daughters to counselors, that they also understand the cultural piece. Okay? That we need people who can work with communities of color, around some of the unique issues that are very, 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 very much right in our community.
Very well said.
It was very well said. I think this is a very important piece of our discussion. I mean, to kind of, we have another call to try and be able to really get to the points we've made about, especially young people and the grieving, and you, and Martha wrote so well about that in her article of describing what goes on in the world today as opposed to before. And this is very critical. I think that we're going to make sure that you know the URL and phone number to get in touch with Roberta's house. It'll be on our website so that people can access that and take advantage of that. And I think that's very critical work that Annette March Greer is doing. Let's try to get another call here for the end of the hour if we can. Let me come back to what Annette's doing. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi. Probably missed it. I'm not sure if y'all mentioned it earlier, but for me, I mean, I'm a single African-American professional woman. I'm a single parent. And, of course, I've experienced death. I lost my father at a very early age. But my thing is, I'm not, if this makes sense to you all, I'm not a funeral person. I've already told my my mother, and actually I have a will again because I'm a single parent. I already told my my mother that I want to be cremated. And, of course, when I mentioned that I wanted to be cremated, her eyes just, you know, got big. And she's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that. My issue is, even though my family, you know, we have insurance, you know, I'm making sure that my son will be taken care of. I would much rather, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think cremation with a memorial service doesn't cost as much as an actual funeral because of the casket and the plot and what have you, and the, you know, the grave site and all of that. I would much rather my son use part of the insurance money, the life insurance, to have a nice memorial service for his mother and to have me cremated, then and use that money later on for, you know, for him to buy a house or, you know, go back to school, start a business or whatever, than to put literally so much money in the ground. And I just wanted to get your, definitely not knocking, you know, it's 2 years
old. Well, no, Martha, this is great, but we only have like a minute left, so whoever wants to grab that as a quick response, please do.
We hear that every day.
Yes,
we hear that every day. And as long as you're communicating with your family and they know your wishes, because the last thing Annette and I want to deal with is a family that is divided about what they want to do when the time arises for the need for death care. Mm-hmm. So, it, you know, make your wishes known by all means. There's nothing wrong with cremation.
Absolutely not. And Martha, there are two very, I think, important vital parts of a ritual that takes place in a funeral ceremony that really helps and facilitates that healing process. And one is the viewing, as hard as it is, as difficult as it is also an affirmation of reality, that the individual, the person that I loved, has really died.
Uh-huh.
Because the mind can play tricks on us, and we do struggle with disbelief when someone we love dies. So the visualization of the body, if that's the way we term it, is so crucial to that finalization. And then, so as far, anything after that is your choice.
I'm sorry I have to interrupt, but this, we are really out of time. This has been a fascinating discussion. I look forward, maybe we'll do this again another day. We had so much more to talk about. Annette March Greer, thank you so much. We'll get people's contacts for Roberta's house. Joseph Brown III, good to have you here. Dr. Ronald Barrett, thank you so much for joining us. And Martha Thomas,
thank you
for writing the article and bringing this conversation to the airwaves. I'm glad you all could listen to our Urbanite radio broadcast. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite delves into hidden phenomena, shadowy characters, undisclosed locations, and other mysteries of Baltimore. It's the Secrets issue, available now at over 800 locations around the region and online at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. When we return from this break, we'll be joined by Leah Gilmore. Stay with us. We'll be right back.